A good gag would be that you consistently think we're talking about Columbia, the country, throughout this.
But that wouldn't even be funny the first time, and it would get less funny as the episode goes on.
What if the bit is that you're very racist throughout this, but towards Colombians?
I was trying to think of a pun with like Zionism.
I can't wait to see Zion. How close to the anti-Semitic gray area you land with this one.
Wait, I have one, Do it.
Michael.
Peter.
What do you know about the protests at Columbia University?
All I know is that none of the chants and none of the signs at any of the protests have made me as uncomfortable as recommending a song by Macklemore.
I guess we have to frame this a bit up top, because as we are recording, we're in the midst of a surge of student protests at universities across the country. Mm-hmm. The protests are about the Israeli attacks on Gaza, and more specifically, they are a call on universities to divest from companies and organizations that profit from Israeli war crimes. It's largely been my opinion and experience that the media coverage of this has been awful.
Atrocious.
And in recent days, we've gotten a heavy dose of police propaganda with a bunch of cameos from my boy Eric Adams, who I've decided will be a recurring character on our podcast.
Dude, this podcast is undefeated with like predicting moral panics in advance. Remember we did retail crime and then the actual retailers like retracted their number?
Target actually sent me a gift card as an apology for that one.
And then now it's like we're talking about all this like deranged propaganda and how these fucking police departments have like more PR people than entire newsrooms. And we get a huge wave of propaganda immediately after these crackdowns.
If Eric Adams gets arrested in the next couple of months, I do think that we did it. Even though we have never talked about his various actual crimes on this podcast.
This podcast has goals.
I wanted to limit this discussion to Columbia University for the most part, because I think the fact that these protests have spread out across the country and have all sorts of sort of different valences in different areas, it's made the coverage more confusing. And I want to sort of do a case study. Mm-hmm. So to contextualize this, student protests obviously have been ongoing since October 7th when Hamas first attacked. And things recently escalated in April when the president of Columbia University, Manoush Shafiq, appeared before the Republican-controlled House Committee on Education and the Workforce in a hearing ostensibly about anti-Semitism on Columbia's campus. This is the same committee that Harvard President Claudine Gay and Penn President Liz McGill appeared before last December, where they were like peppered with bad faith questions, and ultimately both of them had to resign.
Why do people keep showing up in front of these like obviously bad faith committees? This is by far the most baffling thing to me.
Yeah, it feels like for university presidents, this is some sort of mandatory psychosexual humiliation ritual.
It's like everyone who agrees to an interview with Isaac Chotiner, where they're like, look, everybody else just got beclowned, but it might work for us.
So Shafiq, I think she thought she was being crafty, right? She's like, I can learn from their mistakes and do the perfect testimony. So she like gets up there and she's actually very conciliatory toward the committee members. She did her best to like align her positions with theirs. Mm-hmm. She points out how many students Columbia has suspended over the past several months.
Hell yeah.
She was asked about professors who expressed what the committee members felt was support for Hamas's attack. One of them, she says, you know, he was fired and he will never teach at Columbia again. Another who had tenure, she committed on the spot when asked by Elise Stefanik to stripping him of a chairmanship in like a faculty group.
I thought you were going to say committed seppuku on the spot, which I think is what they wanted.
I too am watching Shogun. Now, I do want to send one quick clip just to give you a sense of how much clownery was going on at this hearing.
Are we watching it 1x?
Yes, we're watching it 1x.
Like a fucking pilgrim? Okay, fine.
You don't want to hear these people faster.
That's true, okay.
All right.
Double check, play back, speed normal. Okay, count us down.
Are you familiar with Genesis 12:3?
Oh, no.
Probably not as well as you are, Congressman.
Well, it's pretty clear it was the covenant that God made with Abraham. And that covenant was real clear. If you bless Israel, I will bless you. If you curse Israel, I will curse you. And then in the New Testament, it was confirmed that all nations would be blessed through you. So you do not know about that.
I have heard that. Now that you've explained it, yes, I have heard that
it's
before.
Now familiar. Yeah,
when you've definitely heard of it.
Do you consider that a serious issue?
What?
I mean, do you want Columbia University to be cursed by God?
What?
Of the Bible?
Definitely not.
Okay.
Oh, it's so sad. She's like trying to be nice. But like this guy sounds like a psycho.
Now that you mention it, yeah. No, being cursed by God. Yeah. No, I have heard of that.
I prefer not. Yeah. Also, he's doing the voice that if your friend did it, like while doing an impression of a Republican senator, you'd be like, hey, dial it back. That's really offensive. Like, don't do the cartoon redneck voice when you're pretending to be a Republican senator.
That's why you can't speed that up to 1.5 or something, because you really lose the effect.
The thing is, I was just about to do it, but I was like, no, I people will yell at me if I do it right now. It's like, it's too offensive to do the voice.
I want to hear it, Mike. Look, you can't be racist against like Southern senators or whatever. It's not a thing.
God, her sad smile. I'm not as familiar with that. I don't want the campus to be cursed. We live in hell, Peter.
So when this hearing wraps up, at first it feels a little bit like a PR win. She is sort of complimented by one member of the committee that says she beat Harvard and Penn on this issue.
Okay.
So maybe she's feeling good at this point. But while she was testifying, pro-Palestinian protesters set up an encampment on a campus quad. Hundreds of students pitched about 50 tents, and they state that they will be occupying the space until Columbia divests from Israel.
So is this related to the congressional hearing, or is this just a total coincidence?
I don't think it's a coincidence. I think they knew that administration was going to be focused on the testimony and that would present them with an opportunity, right?
Okay.
And this is a high-profile moment to put pressure on Columbia.
Her performance in the congressional hearing also illustrates the fundamental problem here, that even if you do go in front of Congress and like own the Republican senators and do really well, that's not a news story.
Right.
So the best case scenario for going in front of these ding-dongs is just no news at all.
There is a political instinct missing in the brains of university administrators. That's what I've learned from this whole thing.
Yeah.
She gets back to Columbia and she's faced with this dilemma, right? Because you have these students protesting. Mm. You basically just promised Congress that you were going to rule with an iron fist over these protests.
You don't want to be cursed.
So
you're trying to avoid the
she
curses.
Responds by writing a public letter to NYPD. She says, I write with regard to the encampment on Columbia University's campus that began before dawn on the morning of Wednesday, April 17th, 2024. As discussed, more than 100 individuals are currently occupying the South Lawn of Columbia University's Morningside Heights campus. This group has been informed numerous times and in writing that they are not permitted to occupy this space, are in violation of the university's rules and policies, and must disperse. I have determined that the encampment and related disruptions pose a clear and present danger to the substantial functioning of the university.
Oh my God.
With great regret, we request the NYPD's help to remove these individuals. We trust that you will take care and caution when removing any individual from our campus.
The thing is, I also read that letter, and she mentioned that this has the potential to ruin John Cage's 433. So it's interesting you didn't read that excerpt. I think we need to focus on the real victims.
So Columbia is a private university on private property. They have an agreement with NYPD that NYPD won't intervene on campus unless asked to. So this letter is the president saying, hey, NYPD, come on in. This is something that has not happened since 1968 when there were student protests and NYPD intervened. And it was largely considered to be a big clusterfuck. So legally, they are within their rights here. They can basically tell anyone, students included, hey, we want you off this lawn. And if the students refuse, they are trespassing and can be removed, right?
It is very funny that this whole thing is literally kids get off my lawn. It's kind of perfect.
It's always telling when the charge that protesters get hit with is trespassing.
Yeah.
That's when you know that nothing has happened, that they're being arrested because they were irritating people. I also want to talk about some weird language in this statement. She says that students present a, quote, clear and present danger to the substantial functioning of the university. This is like very crafty phrasing, because at a glance, it seems like she's saying they're dangerous in like the general sense of the word. But
right.
She's saying they are dangerous to the substantial functioning of the university. Which doesn't seem like it's actual danger, you
right.
know?
It's this combination of high stakes and low stakes.
Right.
Because like you could say that about anything. You could say that like you working from home poses a clear and present danger to my ability to watch The Legend of Korra all day. Like it doesn't mean anything.
So also as a lawyer, I kind of perked up when I saw clear and present danger, because that's like an antiquated legal standard from the World War I era that has been overruled. So now the First Amendment test is inciting imminent lawless action. And like the clear and present danger thing, that hasn't been the First Amendment law since the 60s.
Yeah, but there was that Harrison Ford movie in the 90s. And so everybody thinks it's real.
I was sort of like, why is she using this language? Mm. And apparently it's in Columbia's policies. Like I went digging through their policies and apparently they use this like clear and present danger standard, presumably because it's like broader and vaguer, which is why it was overturned to begin with.
Yeah.
But it like sort of still sounds like it's legalese, right? Mm. I also will flag that Columbia policy says that in order to bring in NYPD, the president has to consult with, quote, a majority of a panel established by the University Senate's executive committee. The executive committee said that they were not consulted.
Okay.
The Columbia Spectator, the student paper, which by the way has done the best reporting on this by such a wide margin that it's remarkable.
Yeah.
They asked the school about this and the school responds that Shafiq, quote, consulted with the Senate chair, comply with the consultation requirement. But the requirement is that she consult with a majority of a panel established by the committee. So it seems pretty clear that she just ignored the policy to bust up this protest as quickly as possible.
It's also funny because like breaking the procedure of like how to tell the protesters to disperse is like kind of silly, right? It's a sort of technical procedural thing, which like nobody really cares about, right? But the whole thing is that the entire argument for breaking this up is a little tiny procedural thing, too. It's like they're trespassing on campus.
No, it's even less than that. Columbia's real justification, like what they're putting forward, is that these students were basically violating the protest rules.
Okay.
So the president also sends a letter to Columbia writ large and says, we updated our protest policy to allow demonstrations on very short notice and in prime locations in the middle of campus while still allowing students to get to class and labs and libraries to operate. The current encampment violates all of the new policies, severely disrupts campus life, and creates a harassing and intimidating environment for many of our students.
But then if we're such fucking sticklers for policies, you're also not following your own policies on the procedure for doing this. So it's like, are we sticklers or are we not? I don't think people really care about this procedural stuff, but it's very clear that there's like a huge double standard.
Right. I want to pause before we continue because as this story goes on, it gets messier. I want to be clear that at this point, there have been no credible allegations of like anti-Semitism or offensive statements or violence from any of these protesters, right? When Columbia brought in the NYPD to clear the encampment, they claimed that the protesters were creating a harassing and intimidating environment, but they didn't provide any examples. And I think to this day, there is really no evidence that anyone within this actual encampment did anything of the sort.
Okay.
So it really seems like what happened here is that Shafiq was coming off of her testimony to Congress and then confronted with this dilemma. Do I back up my tough talk or do I sort of let them stay? She calls in the cops, right? So you get this initial round of media coverage that's relatively mild, but you start to see some sort of weird tendencies. So the New York Times says, and they're talking about the clearing of the encampment, they say, many in the crowd watched with a sense of disbelief or anger. Some students, though, those who had felt harassed by the chants and actions of the pro-Palestinian students, said they were glad that the university had finally agreed to follow its rules. again, they're not specifying what the harassing chants or actions were. It's just sort of stated, which is not necessarily to say that it's fictional as much as that this is just bad reporting. Yeah. This is not how you should be reporting on this sort of shit. You can't tell from this whether the complaint here is that they don't like pro-Palestinian chants or that they are actually being directly targeted for harassment by protesters. And that's a pretty important distinction, right?
Right. Basically, is it a normal-ass protest? Or is it genuinely something like rowdy and harassing and something that right. university should really do something about? Like, that's the entire right. point. Is like, is this okay or is this not? Yeah.
So to map this out chronologically, Shafiq testified on Wednesday, April 17th. The encampment was set up that same morning. NYPD cleared it the next day. What happens next is that these students set up another encampment on the lawn, like right next to the first one.
Hell yeah.
And this time the energy is way higher because people are upset by the administration calling in NYPD.
Yeah.
Faculty, many of whom say that they are not actually aligned with the students on the substantive issue, staged a walkout in protests of the administration. And yeah. this is also where you see other encampments and similar protests start to pop up on campuses across the country.
Right. This is the thing. They could have just ignored this in the first place.
Yeah.
I mean, there have been encampments on campuses, like around the country, and it hasn't really been a big deal. And also, isn't the semester ending in like 2 weeks? And they could have just like yeah. let this happen. And like, I don't know, the whole thing is just such a fucking own goal by the university presidents. I mean, I do get it, but I don't get it.
When the argument being put forward is basically, these protesters are potentially harassing, loud, disruptive. Mm-hmm. The scope of the failure is like laid bare, right?
Yeah.
Because this was one protest on Columbia's campus. It is now like a nationwide movement. There have been hundreds of arrests. There have been incidents of like protesters clashing. Mm-hmm. And you can make a pretty coherent argument that like Manoush Shafiq is responsible for all of that.
To try to look good in front of Republican senators.
No, not even senators.
Or who was that fucking guy?
It's House members, which is even
oh,
more.
Oh God, come on.
Even more degrading.
Humiliating.
Barely politicians, right?
Barely adults.
So over that following weekend, there are reports on social media of several instances of anti-Semitic or otherwise offensive conduct in and around Columbia. One person shouted, "Go back to Poland," at pro-Israel demonstrators. One person held up a sign with an arrow pointed toward pro-Israel demonstrators that said, "Al-Qassam's next targets." That's Hamas's military wing. One guy is recorded shouting that there would be 10,000 October 7th.
I know about all those because I read about them on Barry Weiss's Substack.
That's the thing, is you've probably heard all of these because the media coverage of each of them has been extensive.
Yeah, there was also that poor woman who lost an eye in one of the protests, is my understanding.
R.I.P. No, I think she passed. Yeah.
Okay.
No, she didn't survive. It just sounds like we're being very insensitive to someone who's not familiar with that story. You had pro-Israel demonstrators shouting, "Go back to Gaza," at student protesters, calling them terrorists. Mm. There were some minor scuffles, nothing serious, people grabbing flags from one another, things like that. Almost all of these incidents occurred off campus. And from the reporting I've seen, none of them have been traced to actual Columbia students.
Yeah.
It's pretty clear that most of this, if not all of this, is from non-students.
God. In any large protest, someone is going to yell something fucking stupid. Like one out of every 500 signs is going to have something problematic on it. Like, do you remember the anti-war protest in 2003?
Yeah.
There was some like hella dumb shit being said there and some dumb chants and some dumb signs.
And they were still right.
This whole time, I've just been like, why are we fucking talking about this?
Well, the question is, when you see one asshole, do you want to say to yourself, that guy's an asshole? Or do you want to say to yourself, this is emblematic of a broader trend within the pro-Palestinian movement, right? That's the choice you're being confronted with. And the media chooses the second one every single time.
It's also so fucked up because it's like very clearly a distraction from something that is like the actual fucking bombing of Gaza is so indefensible. Mm-hmm. Tens of thousands of people dead. There's like literally children starving. It's like, it could not be clearer what the right thing to do is and like who the fucking heroes and villains are. And yet we're still talking about like, oh, was this chant bad or not?
The vague implications of the metaphor in your rhyming chant are a little bit disturbing
exactly.
to me.
I mean, fuck.
So social media posts of these like anti-Semitic incidents and sort of like violence endorsing incidents, if they're not anti-Semitic, go viral.
Of course.
And very quickly, the tenor of the media coverage changes dramatically. The New York Times writes a piece headlined, "Some Jewish students are targeted as protests continue at Columbia," citing some of these incidents. The piece also does include quotes from Jewish students who are protesting for Palestine and say they feel perfectly safe, which some media outlets have just completely ignored. Yeah. But they do make one omission, and I've seen this almost universally, which is that they don't cover any of the racist rhetoric coming from pro-Israel protesters.
Yeah, it's
which
fucking
was
wild.
Also pretty thoroughly documented on social media that weekend. And that omission creates this impression of a one-sided problem.
The implication of stories like this is that any amount of anti-Semitism or one anti-Semitic person in a crowd of thousands of people protesting is disqualifying. And yet, Islamophobia is also rife among people who are pro-Israel. And yet, that's never disqualifying.
Yeah, I think you're sort of like imagining what a good faith discussion might look like. But yeah, what's really happening here is that reactionaries are just sort of sensing an opportunity to smear the left and also shift the conversation away from what's happening in Gaza and toward what's happening on American campuses, right?
Yeah, that's been so palpable.
So first, I want to talk about the right-wing news cycle that emanates from this. Fox News runs countless stories about what it calls agitators at Columbia.
Love it.
The New York Post has run nonstop stories about this. Mm. I would like for you to guess the number of stories in the New York Post between April 18th and the end of the month referencing the Columbia encampment.
I'm thinking of, remember we did every single story in the New York Times about Hillary Clinton's emails in 1 month, and I think it was something like 43. So like, I'm going to say somewhere in the 40s.
Yeah, the answer is over 150.
Dude, I follow the New York Post on Twitter, and they had a story this morning that was just, the headline was, "Teddy Roosevelt's great-grandson supports Columbia protests."
Tell him.
It's like Steve Roosevelt or something, just some random kid.
That's news, baby.
Someone I've never heard of who is related to a politician has an opinion. Great.
I almost wish that the New York Post had a functional website rather than one that like will destroy your computer if you scroll it for long enough, because it is deeply fascinating to just witness the media diet of your average Staten Island resident. It's like, no wonder they're like this.
The thing is, the fact that you are moving to New Jersey, I feel like means you should be careful making fun of people from Staten Island.
I am moving very purposefully to a town full of wealthy, stick-up-their-ass liberal pussies. Like, people have, like, Black Lives Matter signs in their yard just as just to be performative assholes. You know what I mean?
Yeah, you're moving to, the name of the county is In This House, comma, New Jersey.
So the Post coverage and most right-wing coverage is really expressly calling the protesters anti-Semitic, genocidal, right? On April 28th, they ran an op-ed by the editorial board titled, quote, "Pro-Palestine protests really are seeking a final solution."
Oh my God.
They wrote that, quote, "Israel's war is entirely just. The protest movement consists entirely of the malevolent and the idiotic, Nazi equivalents and their enablers." That is the New York Post editorial board. By the way, I feel like people don't realize what the editorial boards of conservative papers are like, but these people are unwell.
The Wall Street Journal editorial board says shit that like would get somebody kicked out of like a neighborhood barbecue. You'd be like, "I'm sorry, man, we just can't have you around anymore if you're going to say shit like this."
Yeah, you have to leave. Yeah. I am going to share with you a couple of my favorite New York Post pieces on this subject.
Okay.
I am sending you a headline.
"The Columbia protester diet. Anti-Israel students munch on Pret sandwiches, pricey nuts, and sip Dunkin'." Oh, because they're like decadent elites.
The protesters are simultaneously professional terrorists and also the privileged children of wealthy elites.
Also, these kids are the coddled children of wealthy elites. They're still correct.
You know, I think it's cool that some rich kids can step outside their bubble and recognize some injustice, you know, even if they are probably going to give this up and go work at JPM.
That Roosevelt kid is going to be cool for the next 2 years and then immediately go to McKinsey.
I am going to send you an excerpt
from
this harrowing piece in the New York Post.
It says, the anti-Israel Columbia University students hunkering down on the Ivy League's West Lawn received a hefty food delivery Wednesday as they show no signs of abandoning their makeshift tent city. Fruits, nuts, granola bars, and overpriced sandwiches were being handed out like candy to the protesters who were given a 48-hour extension to camp out on the grounds before the administration warned it would clear them out.
Thank you for catching that stellar bit of writing.
Yeah,
they're handing
amazing.
Out fruit like candy. Yeah. You're a professional writer.
It's so evocative. I have a mental image now. The anti-Israel protesters, more than 100 of whom were cuffed by the NYPD last week, had their choice of an array of nuts, including a $17 jar of Good and Gather's sea salt roasted mixed nuts. It is true that nuts, like nut pricing, has gotten out of control.
Okay, but Good and Gather is Target's in-house brand. Right?
Oh, is it really?
So a $17 jar is probably just a large jar of nuts, which actually sounds like a pretty cost-effective solution for a group of people.
Yeah.
Okay.
Cheaper options like Blue Diamond almonds and Planters cashews were also laid out for the students, who are used to shelling out $86,097 in tuition each year. Sandwiches at the UK brand convenience bakery Pret A Manger were neatly lined up along the table. A simple veggie sandwich would cost only $8, but those with any meat between the bread slices cost anywhere between $10 and $14 or even $16 for a salmon option. My God, this is so boring.
Is this so fucking boring and stupid?
Oh, they can get sandwiches.
You don't have a real job if you're writing this professionally. This
Jesus
is not
Christ.
A real job. You are a fake person with a fake life. Also, these are normal sandwich prices in New York. Sorry.
This entire piece should be about the injustice of Biden's economy. Bidenflation that we're experiencing due to his choices.
I told you that they wrote like 150 articles about this encampment and the protest. So like, this is the kind of shit you need to write to hit those numbers.
Yeah. Just like people had food. There was food
available. Someone's going to their editor being like, I looked up the price of those nuts for you, sir, and they're $17. And he's like, run it.
Yeah.
I'm going to send you another headline. This one's a little more serious in the sense that it has sort of spread around the right-wing ecosystem.
Oh, I love this one. George Soros is paying student radicals who are fueling nationwide explosion of Israel-hating protests.
The substantive claim in this piece is that Soros's foundation has made donations to organizations such as Jewish Voices for Peace and the U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights. This is, by the way, a story that the New York Post broke. So this is like original reporting, original journalism they're doing.
The thing is, they did this during the BLM protest too. I remember there was this dumb number that went around that George Soros gave $100 million to like the BLM rioter protesters. And then the actual substance of the claim was that over the course of the previous decade, Soros had funded a bunch of like, I guess like black-led organizations or like things that are kind of tangentially related to like racial justice.
Right.
He's trying to make America more racially equal is actually what they're really saying there.
Yeah.
It's also funny because Soros is Jewish and like this is an anti-Semitic trope that they're invoking.
Exactly. It's so funny that they're doing an anti-Semitic, like they're doing like this abstract anti-Semitic trope while doing their fake campaign against anti-Semitism.
Yeah.
Like, oh my God, just punt me 100 yards. It's very similar to the Black Lives Matter situation. The only evidence that Soros is like paying protesters is that his foundation made donations to the U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights, which in turn has a fellowship that pays fellows, quote, between $2,880 and $3,660.
That number means nothing to me. Give it to me in sandwiches. Give it to me in sandwiches.
That's one sandwich. So three of those former fellows were now organizers in these protests.
Oh my fucking
that is
God.
The evidence. What this actually reminded me of is the fact that there's almost no money in left-wing activism. Like $3,000 for a fellowship from George Soros somehow. Like
decadent.
That's nothing. You think people are out there protesting for a $3,000 fellowship from a couple of years ago? It's like, that's unbelievably low amounts of money.
It's just further evidence that like, yeah, these are rich kids, but also I don't care. Right, because the only way you can do a fellowship like that is if you have some independent source of funding.
Right.
But like, who gives a shit? I don't know, whatever.
There's one thing I wanted to mention, even though I'm not actually sure where it fits in this episode. One of the weirdest outputs of the right-wing outrage machine was that people online were locating protest organizers and like going through their social media history looking for dirt.
Of course.
And they found one kid who had recorded himself on Instagram saying, "Zionists don't deserve to live, and be grateful that I'm not just going out and murdering Zionists," back in January.
Okay.
This gets out. The group that he's affiliated with distances themselves a bit. Columbia bans him from campus. He issues an apology. In some ways, this is sort of unremarkable, at least in the scheme of things. It's like, it's this one kid.
Yeah.
But he gets plastered all over right-wing media. And not only that, there are stories about him in the New York Times, Washington Post, LA Times,
Chicago
Tribune, USA Today, AOL.com. I found CNN, NBC, CBS. I actually could not find a news outlet that did not run a story about this kid.
No,
that's true.
Way.
Like I put in his name and then a news organization I thought of, and I did it like 10 times and every single
Holy
one had
shit.
One.
That just shows how desperate people are for like an actual instance of anti-Semitism that checks out.
The exclamation point on this is that the White House put out a statement condemning this kid's statements.
What?
Yeah. Just such a good example of how aggressively the media and political apparatus alike are highlighting singular instances of misconduct by pro-Palestinian protesters. It's to a point where, in the midst of nationwide protests by thousands of students, the White House is putting out a statement about the Instagram live comment of a 20-year-old.
It's also kind of a counterexample to this, right? Because once people found out that he made these comments, he was ejected from the protest movement.
Right.
He wasn't embraced.
That's the thing, is what else do you want here, right?
Yeah.
Also, I found his Twitter profile and his bio said student/teacher. And I thought that was more offensive than anything I heard him say. So it's time to turn to the reactionary centrists.
Oh, my people. Here we are. This is it.
So Michael Powell runs a piece for The Atlantic titled "The Unreality of Columbia's Liberated Zone." I know that you read this piece, right?
Oh, yeah. Also, Michael Powell is so funny because he worked at The New York Times literally on like the campus free speech beat. Which is the dumbest made up beat I've ever fucking heard of. It's like basically he's our whipping up a moral panic correspondent, right? He wrote articles about how like no one says women anymore. They say pregnant people. Like every fucking article was just like flogging this free speech bullshit. And then of course he gets scooped up by The Atlantic. And now it's kind of amazing. His pieces have gotten at least like 20% dumber.
That's that New York Times difference. You know?
Yeah, the thing, like he used to at least interview people and stuff, but now he's basically just like doing takes, and they've gotten so much worse. And also, like, a lot of his pieces include like pretty major factual errors. Like you can be so sloppy as a reporter on this beat and just get like basic shit so wrong and nobody cares.
The subheading of his piece is "What happens when genuine sympathy for civilian suffering mixes with a fervor that borders on the oppressive."
I love this. The fervor.
The fervor. So he basically goes into the encampment and talks to students and then like comes out thinking that a few of them have allowed their support for Palestine to, quote, blind them to an ugliness encoded within that struggle.
Not that I found any evidence of it.
Well, that's how ugliness is sometimes, you know? You know how you look at someone and you're like, I don't know.
Yeah.
I'm going to send you an excerpt.
As if I haven't already read this like four times.
I know.
I stood in the press zone and waited for Leila Saliba, a social work graduate student who served as a spokesperson for the protest. A Palestinian American, she said she has lost family in the fighting in Gaza. She talked at length and with nuance. Hers, however, was a near singular voice. As I toured the liberated zone, I found most protesters distinctly non-liberated when it came to talking with a reporter. So I know we're going to circle back to the Layla stuff, but again, this is not weird at all that people don't talk to a random reporter, especially a very obvious bad faith actor.
Mm-hmm.
This is normal because everyone is looking for fucking ammunition that these people are protesting for the wrong reason.
Right.
Like these little protest zones are often like, we have like a media person. If anybody asks you questions, send them to the media person.
Which, by the way, is like the same as any organization on earth that functions well. Like you can't just call up like Amazon and just start doing interviews, right? People will route you to PR, right? That's how everything works.
Yes.
But when it's protesters, they make it seem like it's shady. Like they won't talk to me.
I'm stealing this point from my friend Aaron, but after he read this piece, he was like, this is what working at the New York Times does to a motherfucker. Mm-hmm. Where like, if you work for the New York Times and you're like, I'm reporting a story on people will get back to you like 100% of the time.
Right.
Like when
right.
I was writing random magazine articles, it was like my hit rate was like 1 in 4 of like trying to talk to experts and like random people. If you just have like a gmail.com address. So part of it is also Michael Powell's fucking privilege of just like, he's able to get people on the phone and he's like, why won't these people talk to me? It's like, dude, if you're a normal reporter, this is most of the job is trying right. to talk to people and they won't talk to you for whatever reason.
Do you know how humiliating it is to reach out to someone and be like, I have a podcast about books. If you want to talk to me, it's degrading. And the idea that he's just out there getting interviews without trying. Oh, God, it pisses me off.
That my email signature just says journalist. Don't worry about it. I don't specify.
So a couple things. He talks about Layla and says she spoke at length and with nuance, but doesn't
say anything
or relay anything that she said. Meanwhile, this article is full of things that students said that he thought was like inarticulate or naive, right?
Yeah.
And then he quotes them and is like, this is so telling.
Yeah.
Second, and maybe more importantly, Layla Saliba posted on Twitter like, hey, Michael Powell, I didn't tell you my family was lost, quote, in the fighting. They were innocent civilians killed by the Israeli military. In case anyone does not believe this, they're also like Palestinian Christians, right? They're not in like Islamic Jihad or some fucking shit. Powell responds, quote, Layla, as I said family, I think he means fighting, but he says, as I said family, I meant they were killed in this war. That does not imply they were bearing arms. Thanks.
God, he's such a fucking asshole.
A fight is mutual conflict, right? So when you say someone died in the fighting, that absolutely implies they were bearing arms. Does it necessarily mean they were bearing arms? Maybe not. But there was fighting on October 7th, right? If you wrote that a civilian killed that day died, quote, in the fighting, I can almost guarantee you the Atlantic wouldn't run that.
It's also just like morally speaking, I know this technically follows like journalism ethics or whatever, if you want to get chapter and verse about it, but also you're talking to someone who lost her family.
Right.
Right. You can either quote the person in her telling, these were innocent people who were killed for no fucking reason, right? Just quote the person directly. Doesn't mean you have to agree with her, but just quote her fucking words. Also, if somebody gets back to you after an article and says, hey, the way that my family died is being mischaracterized by you in your article, you should fucking fix it, man.
Wait, so what's your favorite segment of this piece?
I just like the thing where he like goes outside. He's like, he's searching around nutpicking. He can't find anything. He finds one incident of like, I guess people chanted, like there were some Zionists there, and then people chanted like, you're not welcome here or something. Which whatever you think about that is really not like that big of a deal. It's the kind of thing that happens in protest encampments all the time. So he clearly just like comes up empty and then just goes outside fishing for like anything that has the fucking smell of anti-Semitism on it, and someone drives by in a car and like yells something anti-Semitic.
Right.
But it's like his process is so fucking obvious. He's walking around with a notepad on Columbia campus. He's talked to like 10 people. He's got nothing. And he's like, I gotta write something. Fuck. And then he just goes outside and he's like, somebody please say something fucked up. Okay. That guy yelled something. Great. Okay. I've got it.
And he's like, jackpot.
And then he runs with it. And no editor, of course, at the Atlantic was like, well, this has nothing to do with the actual fucking encampment.
The whole piece is like the unreality of Columbia's liberated zone. But meanwhile, the only like actual anti-Semitism he encounters is from some random passersby.
From some random fucking guy. He also has this thing, this thing in the headline, that a fervor that borders on the oppressive. He also uses that phrase in the article, which isn't backed up by anything.
What's oppression? What's fervor? What's bordering? You know,
you
throw enough of these words together and it doesn't actually have to mean anything at all.
Again, the problem at the Atlantic is the fucking editors. The editors are never like, sorry, do you mind like just justifying this? Like, what does this mean?
Hey, Michael, what does oppression mean to you?
Yeah, what?
Because you have described only these stray comments of a couple of students at an encampment. So how does that add up to oppression?
All this stuff to say about this is so fucking obvious. All these like free speech warriors. God.
Let's talk about another free speech warrior. My favorite op-ed of this period, and I know you read this one too, John McWhorter.
Dude.
He's a campus free speech guy. He's a linguist, and he's black, which has given him the ability to be like, I'm, you know, the black conservative who thinks things have gotten shitty for white people on college campuses.
Oh, God.
McWhorter writes a New York Times op-ed titled, I'm a Columbia professor. The protests on my campus are not justice.
Not justice.
This starts off with one of the greatest vignettes in recent op-ed history, and I'm going to make you read it.
Okay, so it says, last Thursday, in the music humanities class I teach at Columbia University, two students were giving an in-class presentation on the composer John Cage. His most famous piece is 4:33, which directs us to listen in silence to surrounding noise for exactly that amount of time. I had to tell the students we could not listen to that piece that afternoon because the surrounding noise would not have been birds or people walking by in the hallway, but infuriated chanting from protesters outside the building. Lately, that noise has been almost continuous during the day and into the evening, including lusty chanting of From the River to the Sea. Two students in my class are Israeli. Three others, to my knowledge, are American Jews. I couldn't see making them sit and listen to this as if it were background music. Hard
stuff. You fucking buffoon. I mean, this is so deeply humiliating. He ended up doing like a Twitter thread about, he's like, no, I understand that the piece is about listening to what's around you, but I just don't think we should have to listen to this. The whole point of this piece is it's like fucking performance art about like listening to your surroundings.
Yeah.
And John McWhorter is like, yeah, like birds chirping or something.
Yeah.
It's like, no, if that's what John Cage wanted it to be, he would have made a fucking sound machine.
He would have put birds.
I'm just imagining like, I don't know, there's like a siren and then the professor's like, what the fuck? And like closes the window, you know?
Like, it's like, I don't engage with modern art to be challenged.
Yeah.
I want to hear birds chirping and something pleasant. Imagine if that was the actual purpose of the work.
Right.
He's like, I want to make 4 minutes and 33 seconds of silence so people can hear pleasant sounds.
Turning on 4:33 and then I play Dua Lipa's Don't Start Now over it.
Just as Cage intended.
filling the silence with Dua Lipa.
It's also very funny to me that he's like, well, I can't do 4:33 because there's all the chanting and stuff. And, you know, there's people in my class that are Israeli. There's people in my class that are Jews. But like, this is the same guy who's been complaining about safe spaces.
Yes.
Wait a minute. Isn't the whole thing that kids should hear challenging ideas and let like these kids are being coddled? And yet, like, why shouldn't they hear chants?
Right.
I thought everyone should be hearing slurs and stuff.
Right.
And like, there is an argument for sensitivity in class discussions. Like, no one is saying you need to expose Jewish students to like rank anti-Semitism. But it's like fascinating how quickly all of these fucking guys have just turned on a dime.
I'm going to send you something else from the piece.
God, we could just do like a dramatic reading of this whole fucking thing.
It is. It's the best piece of the era, I believe.
It really is. It really is a classic.
There are genuinely terrible takes, but also he just humiliates himself consistently throughout it.
Like, I feel like a lot of people who agree with him read this and were like, I might be with the students on this one. Maybe I'm joining the encampment. He says, I thought about what would have happened if protesters were instead chanting anti-black slogans or even something like DEI has got to die to the same sound-off tune that From the River to the Sea has been adapted to. I don't know what that last part means.
Yeah.
They would have lasted roughly 5 minutes before masses of students shouted them down and drove them off the campus. Chants like that would have been condemned as a grave rupture of civilized exchange, heralded as threatening resegregation, and branded as a form of violence. I'd wager that most of the student protesters against the Gaza war would view them that way. Why do so many people think that weeks-long campus protests against not just the war in Gaza, but Israel's very existence are nevertheless permissible? Peter, you would feel differently about this if everything about this protest was different.
You would hate this book if the words were all different.
If we replaced the words with different words.
This argument cuts both ways, right? Even if he's right that leftists would try to drive conservative protesters off campus, McWhorter himself has been advocating for tolerance of conservative viewpoints on campus and is now arguing that leftists should be somehow silenced. So, like, to the extent that you think the other side is being a hypocrite about this, you are too.
This is the thing, is everyone has exactly the same view.
Yeah.
Some chants are not appropriate and some chants are. And it depends on the content of the chants. It depends on what people are protesting.
Right.
The reason why the Unite the Right rally was bad is not because it was a fucking rally. I'm not against rallies. It was obviously a fucking racist hate march. That the content of the views is why I'm against it. There's no hypocrisy there.
I also want to point out that he's saying, he's painting this hypothetical where like leftists drive protesters off campus, but like there are pro-Israeli counter-protesters? Have they been driven
campus?
Like, wouldn't
no
that be
yeah.
the sort of best example to focus on? And I mean, it's so easy to be like, you know, what if I created a hypothetical where the leftists were hypocrites? And then you're like, what about that?
Huh? Right.
I got you there with that story I just made
this
up.
This is also the humiliating part.
Right.
Because even in like, these guys fucking panic about campus protests all the time. But like, there have been racist speakers on campus. And like, people have, you know, stood up and shouted them down or written angry emails. No one has called for the police to come in and fucking arrest them.
Right.
So like, there isn't actually hypocrisy here.
I'm going to send you... It's so hard to choose one part of this article
part. I know. He says, calling all this peaceful stretches the use of the word rather implausibly. It's an odd kind of peace when a local rabbi urges Jewish students to go home as soon as possible, when an Israeli Arab activist is roughed up on Broadway, when the angry chanting becomes so constant that you almost start not to hear it, and it starts to feel normal to see posters and clothing portraying members of Hamas as heroes. The other night, I watched a dad coming home with the protest with his little girl, giving a good hard few final snaps on the drum he was carrying, nodding at her in crisp salute, percussing his perspective into her little mind. This is not peaceful. You say it's peaceful, and yet a father went there with his daughter.
That's his definitive, this is not peaceful. Lest you think that I am exaggerating what's happening at Columbia, there was a father drumming.
You're like, nailed it.
So if you're paying attention, he's listing off these like instances of purported violence and is able to name exactly one, an Israeli Arab activist being roughed up on Broadway, which, by the way, is
not
presumably off campus.
Yeah.
He's saying that chanting the portrayal of Hamas as heroic, which he's not being specific, so I'm not sure exactly what he's referring to there.
That's probably River to the Sea stuff.
And also... father drumming.
Yeah.
These are examples of violence in his mind.
Right. Also, I'm stealing this point from Little Joel, but a rabbi warning people that they're not safe isn't violence.
Right. That might come from genuine concern, but it's not inherently violent, nor, frankly, has there just... this violence has never really manifested. It's always just been this, like, ambient thing. There's concerns about safety, and who knows when this will actually tip over, but it never quite does.
This is also yet another thing we see in moral panics of all kinds, right? It's always about to happen. It's about to spill over, right?
One of the projects of all of this criticism of the protests is to characterize things that aren't violent as violent, right?
Mm-hmm.
So they have to stretch to the point of absurdity by like pretending that chanting and drums are violent.
And like, it's a cartoon of like what they keep accusing like Oberlin sophomores of saying.
The last paragraph I had you read, he says that if this were a conservative chant, it would be branded as a form of violence, which he's using derogatorily, right? This is a criticism of the left, the idea that some people on the left argue that speech can be violent. That's something that McWhorter has been critical of in the past. He said a few years ago, you can take it too far if words are violent simply because you don't agree with them or find them slightly noxious. That's where free speech winds up being choked. And now he's like, chanting and the drumming, and when you all add it up, this is not peaceful.
Really violent? Also, look at the final sentence of the piece, Peter, if you have it in front of you.
Okay. Yeah.
Right?
All right. The final sentence of this op-ed, what began as intelligent protest has become, in its uncompromising fury and its ceaselessness, a form of abuse.
Form of abuse. The thing is, these articles turn me into like such a homophobe. I'm like, you fucking pussy. You're walking around thinking this is abuse? A fucking chant?
This guy, by the way, is a linguist. He's like, they're using the words. they're hurting me. When his next book will be called like, When Words Are Bad.
Yeah.
Speaking of the If Books Could Kill extended universe, Steven Pinker,
God bless,
writes a piece that is technically about the encampment at Harvard, but I'm including it anyway because it's all applicable to Columbia, and also I can't resist. So I sent you the headline.
It says, headline, Harvard should shut down campus occupations. Chanting and tenting aren't protected by academic freedom, and university presidents may be justified in calling for the police to break up protests. Fuck off, Pinker.
Doesn't tenting sound like when someone gets a boner in their pants?
Yeah, I'm just going to say, It's like the nice way of saying morning wood. Like, how are you? I've been tenting all week.
Tenting. It's camping. I don't.
That's what I'm chanting and camping. I don't know why you wouldn't just do that. I don't know.
We're going tenting this week.
I go tenting every week.
There's something perfect about tenting, and I'm sorry for focusing on it because it's so stupid. But like, just a guy who's just like not quite normal enough trying to explain what he's seeing. You know what I mean?
Filling out a dating profile of someone who hates camping but like wants to pretend that they do.
Right.
I like tree perusing and tenting. No.
Yeah, I like outside tent. All right, I am going to send you an excerpt.
He says, the right of a university to protect its commons runs deep. Does it? Does it, Stephen? Why do students want to attend a university in the first place rather than stay home and watch lectures on YouTube? Among other reasons, universities offer welcoming green spaces, which encourage casual social interactions and benefit the neighboring community. Won't someone think of the green spaces?
The neighboring community, by the way, is just professors. Like, this is, he's talking about him.
They provide opportunities for faculty and students to engage face-to-face in classrooms and dining halls. They host ceremonies that bind the community and recognize hard-won accomplishments. In the past 6 months, pro-Palestinian protesters at Harvard have tried to interfere with each of these. At other universities, the threats have resulted in cancellation of in-person classes and of graduation ceremonies. Universities have a legitimate interest in safeguarding the spaces and events that make campus life different from a correspondence course. God, they're reaching, dude. They're reaching.
It's brutal.
Oh, you know, the campus.
So, first of all, the canceled graduation ceremony that he's referring to is at USC, where administration refused to let the Palestinian valedictorian speak at graduation,
because they thought
that she would say something advocating for Palestine. That caused an outcry, and then they like canceled the commencement altogether, or at least most of it, to blame that on protesters.
Are you kidding me? It's actually an argument against what he's saying.
Also, though, like, this is a pretty narrow view of why people attend universities. I don't think I have ever heard a person in my life say, like, why did you go to college or what did you like about college? And they're like, oh, the grass?
The square of grass?
The grass spaces are good.
Also, it's funny because if you want to get to the purpose of a university, like being involved in social justice and like learning about world issues is much closer to it than fucking grass.
He's like, oh, it encourages casual social interactions. Like, okay, like there's socializing happening at protests.
Oh, but the thing
is, if anything, there's more.
Stephen means having coffee clutches with famous eugenicists and pedophiles. But it's so telling what these people are like reaching for.
Right.
As like a defense. Like, what about the green spaces? Like, people are starving and dying, Stephen.
Right.
I think it's worth giving up some green space, man.
Gonna send you one last pinker bit.
He says, a university should be a forum in which people offer arguments backed by reason and guided by the search for common ground. It should not be a place where they issue demands chanted in rhyming slogans and backed by threats. Backed by threats. Students should accept the possibility that others will disagree with them, including about which of the world's problems should be prioritized and how they should be solved. No bloc should be permitted to commandeer university spaces or events to harangue the rest of the community. In particular, an ultimatum that a university must divest its endowment for political reasons is incompatible with a major tenet of academic freedom, institutional neutrality. A university should not foreclose debate on a controversy by taking an official stand. This is bullshit. Asking them to divest part of their fucking endowment is like such a light lift.
He's implying that being invested in something is neutral and not being invested is not neutral. Like, what are you fucking talking about, dude?
Also, haven't all of these endowments divested from like tobacco and weapons manufacturers? This is like a really normal thing that has been happening among institutional investors.
It's not uncommon to see divestment from weapons manufacturers, but a lot of them are still invested.
Right.
He's trying to make it seem as if this would like cross a line, but I don't think anyone realistically believes that.
Right.
He's just, again, just reaching for shit. I wanted to include this because he's touching at something that I've seen some of the other free speech reactionaries touch on, and I think you're going to see a lot of. He's implying here that the protests and chants aren't really speech worth protecting, right? He's saying like, these are just demands chanted in rhyming slogans.
The rhyming, I love.
That when it rhymes, that goes down the First Amendment protection totem pole. By the way, I cut out the lengthy portion of this op-ed where he explains the First Amendment, kind of like a 12th grader would, if I had to.
Yeah, welcome to my world, Peter. 900 pages. I did 900 pages of this guy.
So I think what he's trying to say is like, look, free speech is really about like dialogue, right? This like pitter-patter back and forth between people who disagree, and then they come to a compromise.
This is not true.
Very pernicious, right? The idea that like protests are inherently really not free speech because they're not dialogue. I mean, so we have a 5-4 episode coming out where I talk about this, but like protests are not about dialogue. They are about political power, right? There has been a dialogue. The administration has one position. The students have another. And now the students are exerting their political power so that they can get their way. This is how political power works. This is how political power has always worked. The idea that this is not speech is ridiculous.
He says, he starts out, a university should be a forum in which people offer arguments backed by reason and guided by the search for common ground. No, I don't want to find common ground with anti-vaxxers. Kids should have mandatory vaccinations in schools. I don't want to find common fucking ground with people who say there's mercury in them.
In this case, he says the search for common ground. That's also very telling because often these guys will say the search for truth. But if you say the search for truth in this context, you might back yourself into a corner because the truth is that mass murder in Gaza is morally objectionable.
Yes.
So instead, he says the search for common ground, which demands compromise from the students, right?
Also, the arguments are backed by reason if you go down there and talk to them. Like, arguments backed by reason are like, yeah, it's bad to kill thousands of innocent people.
No, they rhyme. They rhyme. That's why people say there's no rhyme or reason.
You've got me there. You got me. It's very funny that it's like the actual protesters are like, you know, you should stop like murdering a bunch of innocent people. And the people arguing on the other side are like, but what about the grassy areas of campuses and John Cage's 433? Like, aren't these the real victims in all of this?
John Cage's 433 is the university quad of the mind. And it should be uninterrupted by protest. All right. So there have been like 5 more centrist op-eds that are basically exactly like these three,
and
so we don't need to go through them. I do want to talk briefly about the politicians' responses to all of this. Mm. Elise Stefanik, who led the Republicans in the original House hearing, calls for President Shafik to resign. Biden, he's asked whether he condemns the, quote, anti-Semitic protests. And he says, yes, he does condemn the anti-Semitic protests.
I mean, I do too, even though there haven't been any anti-Semitic protests.
Well, right. I mean, in his defense, he was just repeating back what the reporter said. But you gotta learn to talk about this stuff. On April 29th, 21 House Democrats signed a letter to Columbia saying, quote, we, the undersigned, write to express our disappointment that despite promises to do so, Columbia University has not yet disbanded the unauthorized and impermissible encampment of anti-Israel, anti-Jewish activists on campus.
That's dark.
Tom Cotton and Josh Hawley and Speaker of the House Mike Johnson called to send the National Guard into Columbia.
Yeah, of course.
Being brought in ostensibly to squash what everyone agrees was at this point a peaceful student protest, right? Like, we'll talk about Hamilton Hall in a second, but at this point, there's no allegations of violence coming out of the encampment.
Yeah.
It's bad, but I am sort of glad that we get to dispose of the idea that the American right buys in to the mythos of the civil rights era, where like the civil rights protests were a good thing. And the shooting at Kent State was a bad thing, for example. Like, they now are just saying, like, well, the civil rights movement was basically a bunch of criminals. And stuff like Kent State, that was good.
They're doing the worst you're wrong about in history. They're like, actually, Kent State was fine. You might think it's bad, but in fact,
I want to do right wing you're wrong about, like, Obama's tan suit. It was, in fact, an insult. To all of us as Americans. You also get the Anti-Semitism Awareness Act. The House passed this so-called law, which expands the definition of discrimination under Title VI, which governs universities, to include certain criticisms of Israel itself. Funniest thing about it, Marjorie Taylor Greene voted no because it categorized saying that Jews killed Jesus as potentially anti-Semitic. And she was like, this is infringing upon our religious beliefs. So fucking perfect. Just a
perfect.
Mwah, just like, yeah, like good luck allying with these people politically.
Yeah,
sure.
Exactly. The whole thing of we're supposed to pretend that these people give a shit about anti-Semitism. Come the fuck on, man.
She's like, look, I would love to vote in such a way that would undermine these protests. But at the end of the day, I do hate Jews and I don't want my right to hate Jews being infringed upon. Things escalate at Columbia the night of April 30th when protesters occupied Hamilton Hall on Columbia's campus. They got in, breaking a couple of windows in the process. Red alert, protests just became violent. If you ask the press, Columbia called on the NYPD once again, and they come in full riot gear, and they arrest the students involved. I would love to explain this in detail, but why have me do it?
Oh, yeah. Eric. When I say Eric, you say Adams.
We should just do little mini bonus episodes every time Eric Adams has a press conference.
So this is the second time in 2 weeks that Columbia has called upon the NYPD to help clear out protesters on campus. Is sending the police in riot gear the best way to de-escalate what is already a tense situation?
Well, there were two operations tonight. One was with CUNY and one was with Columbia University. And once I became aware of the outside agitators who were part of this operation, as Columbia mentioned in their letter and their request with the New York City Police Department, it was clear we had to take appropriate actions. When our intelligence division identified those who were professionals, well-trained, one of them was married to someone that was arrested for terrorism, we knew these children were being exploited and they were in danger and would have been irresponsible not to reply to requests from Columbia University.
We're helping the children. Isn't the term outside agitators just like known as like a moral panic term?
Yeah.
Because it was invoked in such bad faith in the 1960s.
Yeah. I think you're right. Eric Adams, he's doing quiet part loud stuff, not as strategy, but because he doesn't understand anything.
Yeah. America's so dumb now. Everything is so dumb.
These children were being exploited and were in danger.
Wait, why would they be in danger?
So first of all, he's describing them as children, like all college is bizarre. Also, they're being exploited and are in danger. Okay, well, you hit them all with charges after this.
Yeah.
So which ones were being exploited exactly and why did you charge them?
Right.
ABC ran a story titled, "What to Know About Outside Agitators," cops say, are co-opting Columbia protests.
One of them's married to a wife. One of them has a wife. That was all I picked up.
Well, that was the wife of a terrorist. Sorry, I forgot that he mentioned the wife of a terrorist.
The wife of a terrorist.
So yeah, that is a woman who was, by the way, confirmed not to be there. I think she had been at Columbia a week before, and who was married to a man who was charged with like aiding terrorist organizations. It does appear like he was potentially just fucking railroaded under the Patriot Act. A bunch of the charges were dropped. They got him on a plea on some minor stuff.
Uh-huh.
This isn't like Osama bin Laden's wife.
So a man who is slightly shady is married to a woman who was not there. Okay. That's pretty bad. We got to save these kids. Let's crack some heads.
So I'm sending you an excerpt from the ABC news story.
Okay, it says, the arrests at Columbia and CCNY Harlem came hours after Rebecca Weiner, the NYPD Deputy Commissioner for Intelligence and Counterterrorism, said officers have observed outsiders on campus with whom they are familiar from other protests staged in the city over the years. Without identifying them, Weiner said some of the alleged demonstrators unaffiliated with Columbia were active in the Occupy Wall Street protests of 2011, the 2020 so-called Autonomous Zone protests in Minneapolis, Minnesota, following the police killing of George Floyd, and the ongoing Stop Cop City demonstrations opposing a police training facility in Atlanta.
Yeah, we're getting reports of people who believe in multiple things at these protests.
Also, the photographic memory to remember people from 2011 Occupy.
The main claim here is that some portion of these protesters are outside agitators, people who like come in from all over the country to stir up trouble. This is something that has been used, like you mentioned, since the civil rights era. It was used by the John Birch Society back in the 50s. They were claiming that like communist agents were stirring up trouble in the U.S., which actually is like slightly more coherent than the argument now.
Yeah, like, yeah. Because like who would be paying for this now? Like Hamas?
Exactly. Right. It was used by George Wallace to explain the march to Selma. It was used in 2014 in Ferguson and in 2020 by not just the Trump administration, but like various mayors during the George Floyd protests, which like you literally had mayors in like every city being like outside agitators. And it's like, okay, so like, do these agitators all live outside of cities? Like, which city are they from?
Yeah. They're all from the Soros fellowships.
The idea is obviously to like delegitimize both the protest and the protesters to like basically make it seem as like, this is not a group of people with principles. It's a group of people who just want to cause trouble.
And again, these are people like protesting against very well documented mass murder of civilians. It's not it's actually not that hard to believe that people are upset about it on its face.
I'm going to send you another Eric Adams video.
We've heard from your team that there are these nameless leaders who were involved. Can you tell us who they were or at least how many of them there are?
First, I always suspected that something was happening, and I'm happy that the confirmation of my suspicion turned out to be accurate when our intelligence division briefed me on two particular individuals. One of them, husband, was arrested for terrorism as well. Some of the paraphernalia and pamphlets that we saw, individuals we saw who were not CUNY students, were there training individuals. We saw the escalation of the tactics that were being used. And so it has been reported on some of the individuals that just stated, I choose not to give notoriety to people who participate in activities like that, but it has been online. The police department has reported. And I'm sure if you reach out to the intelligence division, they'll give you based on the information we want to release. And this is extremely active, continue to evolve, and we want to continue to do the thorough investigations that we have been doing.
How does anyone fall for this?
Dude, this man is dumb as bricks.
Oh, if you reach out to the intelligence people, they'll tell you the fucking, you're the boss of the intelligence people.
Yeah.
And also you're like, oh, we do have people, but I can't give you the names out of consideration for the terrorists.
Guarantee they just rehearsed this and he butchered the Arabic names so badly a couple times that they were like, just why don't you just tell them
just
to
say
call
we can't.
Us.
Yeah.
So you have him once again referring to someone who we know wasn't there. And by the way, by this time, they knew wasn't there too.
I've looked into enough moral panics that I feel like there are some things that should be self-refuting. If somebody says there's outside agitators, you should just require proof of that before you air it, right? Because they say this at every fucking protest. The whole thing is trying to delegitimize it by saying no one actually believes this stuff. So
like, I have a fantasy of getting an anchor job and just immediately being like, so obviously you are lying to me and
you are
a liar. and like just like ruining my job, but just doing it once.
What is the point of having professional journalists if they don't have at least the tiniest sense of history? They're like, oh, this is something they always say.
Mayor Adams, this has been proven untrue. And also, you can barely speak a sentence. That's my dream interview. All right. I've sent you a status. This is not a video. This is a tweet from NYPD Deputy Commissioner Kaz Daughtry.
Okay.
He recently appeared on Newsmax to push this outside agitators story. But I just want you to read this tweet for me.
I like that you're moving to New Jersey, and so you're finally ready to piss off the entire NYPD on the way out. Close that door. Burn that bridge, Peter. He says, pencils, books, laptops, those are the tools of students and what you expect to find on a college campus. But here's what the NYPD found at Hamilton Hall at Columbia University after we were able to arrest the protesters and agitators for commandeering and barricading themselves inside the building. Gas masks, earplugs, helmets, goggles, tape, hammers, knives, ropes, and a book on, all caps, terrorism. These are not the tools of students protesting. These are the tools of agitators, of people who are working on something nefarious. Thankfully, your NYPD was able to prevent whatever they were planning and stop them before they could do it. Continue to peacefully and lawfully protest, but know that if you engage in illegal conduct, the NYPD will hold you responsible and hold you accountable. Someone has to. I love that he's like, whatever they were planning, like, well, we haven't looked into it or figured anything out, but like,
yeah,
they were obviously planning something very bad.
So first, let us talk about what has been making the rounds on the internet. The book on terrorism.
There's a photo here. It's Terrorism, A Very Short Introduction from Oxford University Press.
He literally is presenting this and he has like held it up on television on Newsmax as like, look, it says terrorism on the front. He's acting like it's like how to do terrorism. It's the textbook for a course taught at Columbia this semester. So like it was just in Hamilton Hall and these fucking mouth-breathing dipshits stumbled upon it and were like, ooh.
The worst gotcha. This is the worst gotcha.
It's also very funny when they say like, oh, they have gas masks. And it's like, yeah, because you guys gas them?
Yeah, because you're gassing them.
Why do you think they have earplugs? What, like helmets? Like, they have all sorts of ways to protect them from us, and the violence that we constantly do.
Also, the photos here, it's like a bunch of bike helmets. And then there's like a bike lock and just like a random hammer. One of the photos is just a blank table with a hammer on it.
So regarding the bike locks, an NYPD representative went on Morning Joe and held one up and said, this is not what students bring to school. This is what professionals bring to campuses and universities.
Ladies and gentlemen, we got him.
And yeah, the New York Times did in fact confirm that the type of bike lock he was holding is available for sale on Columbia's campus. Because students get their bikes stolen sometimes. So what you do is you lock them up with the bike lock.
Bike Twitter loved this. This was the intersection of like both my Twitters, like leftist Twitter and bike Twitter, finally.
I thought you were going to say gay Twitter and bike Twitter, and I was going to make a joke about how they're the same thing, but all right, fine.
I feel like, but the canonical bike Twitter tweet about this was that like, of course they've never seen this before because they've never investigated a bike theft in their fucking lives.
Right. That's the quintessential good luck kid. Like you go to the cops, like my bike was stolen. They're like,
sounds tough.
Kid, we don't even solve murders around here. So you also get politicians describing this as violent. So Biden, of course, is like, this is his moment to give another speech alienating young people, which is his strategy. He says, dissent is essential for democracy, but dissent must never lead to disorder.
That's
vandalism, trespassing, breaking windows, shutting down campus, forcing the cancellation of classes and graduation. None of this is a peaceful protest.
Isn't it, though?
Anyone on earth that would describe trespassing as a violent crime?
Also, canceling stuff is just not that big of a deal.
No, like canceling class. You have caused classes to be canceled, and therefore your protest is not peaceful.
Yeah, there's many reasons why that would happen. That could also be because there's fucking cops all over the place on campus and like tear gas canisters and shit.
Right. I have seen people characterize breaking windows as violent. I understand why people would say that. It's certainly not like peaceful, but I would generally understand violence to mean something directed at a human being.
It's so bizarre that we're supposed to care about some fucking windows being broken at a extremely wealthy university campus when like people are dying, Kim. Like,
you know, I've been to many like Ivy League campuses in the last few years, and I would say that like there's a general dilapidation around some of the old buildings, and I've never seen anyone really complain about it because no one actually gives a shit about the windows at Columbia University.
Yeah, no one cares.
It is important to understand that what the media is doing here and what these politicians are doing with this rhetoric is manufacturing consent. They want to conflate the median pro-Palestinian protester on Columbia's campus with the person shouting some anti-Semitic shit on the street.
Yeah.
They want to conflate a protester who's holding up a sign with like the idea of some like professional agitator.
Right.
All of that is designed so that they can justify the use of force and dismiss the substantive issues being raised by the protesters. Like the reality of the Columbia encampment is that there are so many Jewish participants that there was a large and well-attended Passover Seder on the same day that Elise Stefanik was saying that the protests were overrun with anti-Semitism and President Shafik needed to resign.
Yeah.
Right? no reported instances of violence in the encampment to this day. And yet McWhorter is writing in the New York Times that the protests are not peaceful. Like, if you're the median news consumer, you see every news story about the protests coupled with questions about anti-Semitism, violence, and safety, and you start to associate them. Right?
So many of the public debates that we're having feel like they're just, they serve as distractions. And like the fundamentals of the issue are very clear and have been clear for a really long time. And no one even bothers defending anything on the merits, right? But the minute you say, like, wow, this is really bad, they're like, well, some of the people trying to stop it have, like, bad views or something. Mm-hmm. Unless somebody gives me a very good reason to believe it, I'm just going to assume that, like, the super well-documented, like, deaths of people are why students are upset. I'm also upset.
Right.
It's upsetting.
I remember when probably one of the most visceral examples of how bad faith these operations are came out of, I think it was Northeastern, where administration sent in police to break up a protest because someone was alleged to have been chanting, "Kill the Jews." It turns out that was a pro-Israel protester
mocking
the pro-Palestine protesters.
Yeah.
Administration not only didn't apologize or walk anything back, they were like, well, no matter who was saying it, we oppose that type of rhetoric. And it's like, well, what are you fucking talking about? They're comfortable with the thinnest excuses because all they're looking for is the excuse, right? The goal is to get to the place where you can unleash the cops.
It's also a huge problem that like anyone can hold up any sign and we don't know who these people are. I mean, I'm not going to say that every single one of these people is like some sort of plant, but like any instance of anti-Semitism is going to become a fucking nationwide story. So any dumbass can go down there and create a fucking nationwide story out of nothing.
I didn't want to talk about that like infiltrator concept too much because I don't want to make it seem as if I blame any given incident on an infiltrator.
Yeah, same. Yeah,
but
yeah.
It is pretty unquestionable that some of the instances that you have heard about are someone coming in from the right, trying to stir up bad media, bad press for the left. I mean, that's really unquestionable. It happens in every single protest. It's well documented in the context of 2020. And there's no doubt that when like the smoke clears, there will be evidence of it here.
Whether or not you believe a specific incident is due to some sort of like right-wing bad faith actor, the dynamics are such that like anyone can go down there and chant anything.
Yeah.
So it's like we just need to be really careful with this and also ask like, what does it fucking matter if like one protest sign is bad? I don't know. Like, it just feels so obvious that this entire thing is just like no one actually cares about this stuff.
We haven't seen this at Columbia, but it is sort of reaching ahead now that you have developments at UCLA where
was awful.
Pro-Israel side is pretty expressly and openly violent.
Yeah.
Have initiated violence repeatedly, gotten people hurt, people hospitalized. Cops have not cracked down because they're on the same side. Because that's how this fucking works. Because the cops operate against the left. They always have. Mm. They defend established hierarchies, blah, blah, blah. Read all, you know, fucking mountains of literature about this. Mm. But it's true.
Yeah.
It's not like leftist conspiratorial bullshit that cops help the right. They are on the right. They are individually politically on the right, and they are institutionally on the right.
Yeah.
The last thing I want to say, I guess, is that this shit happens every protest cycle.
Mm.
And the older I get, the more infuriating and predictable it gets.
Yeah.
Like the first time I saw this was the Iraq War.
Mm.
You saw it again with Occupy. You saw it again in Ferguson. You saw it again in 2020. You see it now.
Yeah.
These media cycles like just rinse and repeat every single time. It's the same exact playbook. It works very well, and it works very well because the media plays along every single time.
Yeah.
It shows what exactly the media's sort of broad function within our political system is, and like that it will in fact defend the status quo, that it will defend these existing hierarchies no matter what the cause is, right? Like all these fucking causes are like every cause students have hit the streets for in the past 70 years, they've been proven to be right, right?
Yeah.
It doesn't matter. The next one, the media will still oppose.
Yeah, from the river to the sea, the press will be chicken shit.